A fool can ask more questions than a wise man can answer. So it took about 30 years before people actually could build those devices. But now we have these devices. They're called quantum computers. They're out there, and we use them for these type of chemistry simulations, material science simulations, but also more recently, less quantum native problems. So people are experimenting with quantum enhanced machine learning. We ourselves are, for instance, also solving differential equations with quantum computers. People are using them for broad class of optimization problems. So there's a lot of both quantum native and non-quantum native, more classical problems that you can solve on a quantum computer.
Hi, my name is Gareth Thomas from Tangible Computing.
And I'm Andrew Rutgers, co-host.
This is a podcast about where computing meets the real world, from the fast and the complex, like controlling an engine, to the imaging of a patient, or even scheduling an airline. We want to trigger your curiosity by talking to the people behind the scenes of making the modern world happen, deepening your understanding of where computation plays a role in our everyday lives, and motivating you to help engineer a better world. This podcast is powered by Version Bay, a consulting company that offers experienced consultants to professionalize your MATLAB, Simulink, and Python projects, minimizing the risk and quantifying the value in migrating to newer software environments.
And now, let's find out how software drives the world.
Today, we're interviewing Benno Brewer with Pascal. Now, they've recently merged with Q & Co., where Benno used to work, and they do software and hardware for quantum computing. So first off, can you tell us what Q & Co. and now Pascal are doing for quantum computing?
Sure. Q & Co., which I founded in, 2018, together with Vincent Elfing, and my CTO, develops quantum algorithms and quantum software that runs on quantum computers, quantum hardware. And so far, we've been working with a lot of different quantum hardware players as partners, where we try to implement our algorithms and software on their hardware and try to optimize the performance of our algorithms on that hardware. And now we've merged with one of those players, and that's Pascal, a neutral atom-based quantum computer developer from France. And together, we're now a full-stack quantum computing company, so we can offer anything from the hardware all the way up to the applications and the middleware, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what we do. And we do that in quite a lot of different fields of applications, but we'll probably talk about that more later on.
Yeah. So what are some of the key applications for quantum computing now?
It's a little bit of a hammer looking for a nail type of problem. You can imagine it's a deep tech, and people haven't figured out exactly all the applications that you could run on them. So part of our work is to find these new applications together with our clients. But to give some examples of what people are doing with it, what people have tried, and where we are expecting some great benefits. Some examples are, for instance, chemistry material science type simulations. It makes a lot of sense. These are quantum native type problems. So you would expect that a quantum computer, which is a quantum native device, would be more efficient at running those type of simulations.
Because the quantum atoms are, the quantum effects between the atoms are actually what you're attempting to model in the simulation. Being able to basically just run that in the quantum computer, in effect, you have an analog of the device that's in your computer, and that makes it an effective simulator.
Yes, indeed. This was actually one of the earliest premises that when people came up with the idea, or actually asked the question, can we build quantum computers? That was in the, as far as I remember, 1980s or something like that, when people started to do physics and chemistry types of simulations, quantum native problems. But they tried to do that on classical computers. And of course, they found out it scales very poorly. And one of the solutions that people came up with is, wouldn't it be great then if we can put that quantum mechanics inside of a box, put some knobs on the outside, and make it into a miniature laboratory where we can just experiment with the quantum physics or the quantum chemistry. And a fool can ask more questions than a wise man can answer. So it took about 30 years before people actually could build those devices. But now we have these devices. They're called quantum computers instead of quantum simulators or miniature laboratories. I guess that does less of a good job in selling the devices. So now we call them quantum computers. They're out there and we use them for these type of chemistry simulations, material science simulations, but also more recently, less quantum native problems. So people are experimenting with quantum enhanced machine learning. We ourselves are, for instance, also solving differential equations with quantum computers. People are using them for a broad class of optimization problems. So there's a lot of both quantum native and non-quantum native, more classical problems that you can solve on a quantum computer.
So can you go a little bit deeper on this idea of differential equations? So I think usually as an engineer, right, I never think of solving differential equations using a quantum computer. I typically will open, I don't know, my MATLAB or my Python or use some kind of library and off I go. Can you go a little bit deeper of how and why that would actually, quantum computing could play a role there? Is it the speed, accuracy? A bit of both? I'm curious.
In any type of simulation, whether it be in chemistry or differential equation solving, it will always be a balance between accuracy and runtime, so speed. So if you can increase the speed of your computation, then either you can, again, sacrifice some of that speed to get better accuracy or vice versa. So it's always a trade-off. But historically speaking, if people solve these type of differential equation problems, like for instance, in fluid dynamics, they would typically use a method like finite element method or something like that, where you discretize your space into a lot of grid points, and then you do a lot of computations on that, which can get you quite far, but people have started to run into some limits with those methods. And then another way of approaching those same problems is what people have started to do maybe in 2016, 15, using neural networks to actually solve these same type of problems. Those methods are called like physics-informed neural networks. And typically what you do in such a method is you use a neural network as a function approximator. So you train it on points X and it spits out some function of X, and you can do order differentiation, like with back propagation, whatever. So you can create an output that would be df dx. And if you have an output of f of x and df dx, then of course you can test whether that output conforms to some loss function that is created out of these differential equations. And if it isn't close to your desired the loss function, if it doesn't fit well, then you just update the weights in your neural network and you converge to a solution. And since 2016, 17, people have shown that this can work very well in classical neural networks already. And slowly this field is coming out of academia, making its way to industry. And what we did when we started to investigate quantum enhanced methods for solving differential equations, we actually took that approach, but then replaced this classical neural network with what you could call a quantum neural network. We're basically using a certain quantum circuit that is called a quantum neural network as a function approximator. So we can train it on points X, and then it spits out some function of X, and we can do circuit differentiation so that we can create df dx. And then again, we test it against the loss function, which makes it a quite nice flexible method because you can put a lot of complexity in that loss function. And then we basically variationally update the parameters of our quantum circuit and then converge to a solution to these differential equations.
It seems like this approach is valuable in the cases where this function is very computationally expensive to begin with, that you Correct. Need to have quite a complicated one, that if the function is 1+1 or, you know, n plus one, then I'd be much better just running that in the classical computer. And really the only value in this is that your neural network approximation has a faster runtime than actually just the direct equation itself. Or in the case of something like a differential equation where it may not be perfectly solvable, but in any case that you get a speed up. And then the quantum one would equivalently, you need to go after the functions where that's truly costly enough to require that, or that where you, the quantum computer has an advantage.
Yes, indeed. Basically, we're using this quantum neural network to create a very large basis set for function fitting. And we did a paper on it. You can find it on our website. And there you will see how we used a certain quantum feature map that then creates some Chebyshev polynomial basis set. And with this quantum circuit, we can create, at least in theory, an exponentially large basis set, which is great if you have a very complex function that you want to fit, also with some overparameterization. There are some benefits in convergence speed, etc. But indeed, it doesn't make sense to do that for a very simple problem. And that's a general thing or misconception that I noticed on quantum computing. And that's people typically say, quantum computing, oh, that's going to speed up all the computations. And I think the misconception was sort of started when people started talking about Shor's algorithm and its ability to break encryption. And it was always about, yeah, it can break encryption because it's a lot faster. So then people started to believe quantum is faster. And then they put at everything behind that.
Mm-hmm. If I think about quantum computing, you have very few bits. Even the biggest quantum computers now, 20, 30 qubits?
The ones that we have at Pascal are 200 qubits.
Okay.
So in the laboratory, we even have a 500 qubit system, okay. But still, I mean, tiny compared to...
Yeah, if I compare that to the memory in my computer and frankly, any device now, and this is absolutely trivial, that is enough for 256-bit cryptographic key is reasonably sized. And so if you would be able to solve cryptographic problems where you have a very small number of bits and a very large number of possible answers or a very large number of possible combinations and states, there the kind of quantum computing makes sense for... traditional sort of compute, like computational fluid dynamics, where you're just, like you say, you're building a mesh over everything, and then you just have a very large amount of data that you need to be moving around. It seems that would be a more difficult one to put into quantum computing.
Basically, you can say that you need that complexity for the quantum computer to shine for several reasons. One of them being that it's still very hard to put a lot of data into a quantum computer, basically encoded in the wave function or something like that. And it's also quite difficult to get a lot of data out of the quantum computer in an efficient way. So typically what you want is a sort of a problem that will be constructed like an apple and a stick type of problem. Small input, small output, large complexity in the middle. Those are ideal sort of problems for solving with a quantum computer. And chemistry is such a problem. Right? You don't need a lot of information to describe, hey, how many electrons do I have? Is the nuclei, are these important or not? And then the output, yeah, typically you want some energy level, some higher order parameter or higher level parameter as an output. So that's still okay. But then there's a huge complexity in the middle. It's a very complex many-body problem with all these electrons doing stuff. So that's a nice problem. But what doesn't work well is a relatively simple computational step, but then you have a lot of it, like a huge data set going in, and then just, I don't know, simple math or relatively simple math, which you can easily do in parallel or something like that.
So graphics cards, for instance, an existing graphics card is pretty good at what it does. And quantum computing isn't going to do anything for figuring out however million or a few million pixels worth of virtual environment are going to look on your computer.
Yeah, and that translates very well to this problem of solving differential equations, because when we started our work on that and figuring out how to use a quantum computer for that, the approaches that were out there tried to do it the wrong way, in our opinion, at least. They try to mimic finite element methods, try to sort of take that huge grid space that was out there and put it in the quantum computer, so basically encode a lot of data in the amplitudes of the wave function. And we cannot do that efficiently. And then once you have the answer, you still need to get it out. So that's difficult. If you then have to measure every individual qubit 1,000 times, then you might lose your speed up. And this is typical to what I'd like to call quantum machine learning 1.0. is what people did a couple of years ago. And if you read those scientific papers carefully, the first couple of sentences are typically like, let's assume that we have our data encoded in the quantum computer. Mm-hmm. And then there's a huge speed up that is explained and it's fantastic and whatever, but that nasty little line in the beginning is a huge issue. So rather than doing that, we started with a method that is less data intense, like physics informed neural networks. You're using all the knowledge that you have about the physics by putting that in the loss function. And by doing that, you're reducing the need to have a huge data input already. And then the second thing is, we're not using amplitude encoding. We're actually, what I said, we're using the quantum computer to create that basis set, which we'll use for function fitting. So we're actually working with the limitations of quantum processors in a smart way, and then still achieving computational advantages, which is great. And I think over the last couple of years, researchers in the field have become a lot smarter at working with those limitations and with the strengths of quantum processors, and people are figuring out where we can apply them in the best way. And so we'll see a lot of progress in this field over the next couple of years.
What do you think one of the first applications that is going to hit day-to-day life of quantum computing?
I'm fully biased. I think solving differential equations.
It comes up a lot every day. Yeah. Yeah. To a regular person on the street, how is their life going to change because of quantum computing first?
That is a very good question. It will be a long time before they will realize that some of the stuff that quantum computers will bring actually affects them. The first distinction I think we need to make is there are sort of one-off computational problems that if you can solve them, offer a lot of value for any corporate. Like in corporate research, you try to build some device, but it doesn't work. And you don't know why. And you need to simulate it to be able to do that, but you cannot simulate it. It's too computationally intense.
Or in the chemistry and drug space, if I can figure out the right molecule to bind with a receptor, and that turns into a miracle drug.
Yeah,
and this is very high value. Quantum computing was done once 5-10 years ago, and now everybody has this drug that is solving whatever the problem is.
And the cool thing about that, if you're developing deep tech, is that there's not really that much time pressure. So it's okay to tweak your device for months and to tweak your algorithm for months because you're looking for that one breakthrough. So I think that in the short term, we'll see those type of applications, where you're getting a sort of a one-off benefit on this problem and then a one-off benefit on that problem. But it might take a couple of weeks or in the beginning, a couple of months or maybe even a year before the first success on that specific problem takes place. And then the next success takes a little bit shorter and a little bit shorter. And until the time that, we're ready to put quantum computing also in a production environment. But it will take some time before quantum computers will run the factory day to day. Maybe an intermediate solution or an intermediate application could be something like computational finance, where you can build or develop a certain algorithm, make sure that it works really well on a certain quantum computer, and then run it for a while to find some inefficiencies in the market and trade on that. But the inefficiencies will then disappear. So you have to figure out another thing, but then at least you run it for some extensive period of time and make money along the way.
Certainly what happened with black holes in the late 70s was that was the formula that I think they subsequently won a Nobel Prize for it, but it allowed them to actually price options mathematically more reasonably than had been done before. Previously, they'd just been based on the trader's knowledge and expertise. And so they were able to find some market advantage, but you had to have a computer and they would run the computer and print out this giant book of option tables that they'd calculated. And so that turned into a major sort of advantage for the financiers who had this deep tech tool. And then this was late 70s and just the basic computers. The computations are now absolutely trivial, but potentially I could hit that kind of thing. Another one that comes to my mind is things like a schedule, because if you can use resources more efficiently, and certainly in my business, that usually means a transit bus, but it's a very similar problem for airlines, for delivery couriers. Do you see quantum computing being applicable in that space?
Yes, at some stage, definitely. There's good research showing that you will get some speed ups there. The issue in the short term with it is that the speed ups are relatively modest. Quadratic or at least polynomial speed ups is what people expect. And it's easy to lose such a speed up in some computational overhead that you incur in the process of realizing. Plus, in many cases, the classical solvers for that are already quite efficient.
I can throw the classical solver at it for another 20 minutes and get a better answer because I just let it iterate more. And I can do that on my laptop with no particular problem. And if the quantum computing isn't turning a 3-week problem into a 10-minute problem or that kind of scope of advantage, then I'm better off just leaving my laptop running for a while.
Yeah, so that means that either you need many more qubits, which will take some time to before hardware developers have them. And on the other hand, maybe the algorithms can still improve or something like that. But in general, for such a problem where the speedup is sort of modest, not irrelevant, but modest, the crossover point will be a little bit further away, right? Like larger problems, longer, more complexity, basically, before you can see an advantage from the quantum computer.
So maybe to piggyback off on that line, Benno, it seems that the embedded system world iterates that the world gets more complex and you just don't have a CPU, right? So you have a CPU and then maybe you have a graphics card and there's a subset of problems that the graphic card deals with and the CPU does something. And then maybe you start combining an FPGA because there's a subset of problems that an FPGA works nicely with versus a GPU. And then more recently, you get neural networks, dedicated hardware, which are very good on that. It feels to me that the future of an embedded system will be almost like a combination of all of these technologies merging. And the name of the game is finding that subset of problems that works really well and be able to distinguish that in an automatic way. And that feels like a bit of where things are going, but maybe more towards the untangling the word of quantum computing, right? So people, I think, generally have a very vague idea of it. And I think there's very different aspects, right? There's the algorithms itself that you're looking at. There's the hardware itself that you're building to make things work. And there's also the computing communication element that plays a big role in how you get your information from A to B. I think these are three very different research areas to the best of my understanding. Mm-hmm. And I would actually like to piggyback, if I understand correctly, on your expertise on the algorithmic side is, how do you actually develop algorithms for hardware that is limited or not existent or changes dramatically from vendor to vendor, that the fundamental physics are different? How do you actually go and create a company that has algorithms and abstract away from that? I'd be curious to learn how you tackled this problem.
Yeah, I think it's a very good and valid question. Our opinion on that or our view on that has changed over the years. When we started in this field, we try to answer that question. You just posed, like, how can you abstract away from these differences? And because we had the naive idea maybe that there were already like standards in the market for quantum, or at least some of these players had the knowledge and the wisdom of proposing a standard that ultimately, because big players were already in the game, like IBM was a big player when we started, and they have a certain approach to it. They do these two-dimensional sort of architectures with nearest neighbor connectivity on the qubits and things like that. It takes a certain algorithm to work with that really well. And people didn't think about, oh, but maybe this isn't the standard. Maybe we have to look at it a different way. And over the years, we found out that all these quantum processors are still completely different. Each of them has its own limitations, its own strengths. Some have more qubits, others have faster gate times, others have less noise, better connectivity, you name it. Some are operating at room temperature, others in cryo fridges and the likes. And so you have to really understand what you're working with. And you need this really close collaboration between the person and the persons developing the algorithms, understanding what you can do with these algorithms and how you can tweak them, or how you can realize the same mathematical result with slightly different types of quantum circuits. And then you need these people who are developing the hardware, and they know, okay, now I've set it up in that way, but I could also do it differently. And these sort of need to start brainstorming. Okay, we have this limitation. It doesn't work. The runtime is too long. How can we overcome that? What do we really need this? Do we really need that? Can we tweak that? Can we change this? That's the sort of discussions that you need to have if you want to make it work. So the idea of some brilliant algorithm developer in some garage in splendid isolation coming up with the next big breakthrough, probably not. So the way it works at Q&Co, or used to work at Q&Co, now at Pascal, because it's become a lot easier now, we have these hardware people inside our own company. Yeah? So we can easily say, hey, let's sit down and see how we can tweak this algorithm or the hardware. But the way we do it is, on the one hand, we have a lot of these research collaborations with academia, with research groups that have the ability to come up with these brilliant new ideas, these concepts, these algorithm concepts. And like, for instance, the research that led to this breakthrough in the differential equations was done together with Exeter University in the UK. And without brilliant scientists like Professor Kurienko in that group, who come up with a brainwave like, hey, this could work. Let's try to make it work. And you're not going to get there. Because internally, as a company, you can employ postdoc level quantum algorithm developers who are probably very good at doing applied research, working with clients, taking an existing concept and then making it work for a certain application. But the broadness and deepness that you need to come up with completely novel algorithm concepts, that's a problem that's much better suited for academia. So we look for these research collaborations with academia, explaining to these researchers, okay, it would be great if at some day we could solve this type of mathematical problem. Don't worry about the application. We know that there are applications, but this mathematical problem needs to be solved. And ideally, we would like to figure out if it's solvable in a better way with a quantum processor. And then together, we go into this long, lengthy process. It can take, for the differential equation, took about a year before we had the first sort of results there. And that's the important step one. You need an algorithmic concept that at least promises quantum advantage in the long term.
Yes, I guess the question that comes to mind is, because it's novel and it's different, I'm assuming not everybody has super easy access to a quantum computing to play around with that. So your problem definition in academia is always a vital step. But if you have an hypothesis and you can't try it out, then your problem definition becomes increasingly more important. I guess the question is, when you're developing these algorithms, did you also need to spend and allocate a lot of time and effort in creating a framework where people could try out these ideas? So it's not necessarily only the algorithm itself, but all the surrounding simulations that people could say, oh, this would work on certain hardware architecture that we choose. Did you have to spend time developing that to empower people and the team around you? Or was that something you were picking back of something that already existed?
The interaction with the hardware actually comes after this fundamental stage. So if you develop this fundamental building block algorithm, that's mostly a theoretical thing. So yes, you do a lot of simulations, but the problem sizes are tiny. So you can do that on a laptop with a quantum circuit simulator still. You don't need a quantum processor for that first step. Remember that you're mostly worried or interested to figure out if that algorithm promises quantum advantage. So what you want to start with is the ideal situation, a completely utopian, noiseless, fully connected quantum processor, for instance. And if your algorithm doesn't show any promise of longer-term quantum advantage on that one, then you can forget about the real devices. So you want to start in this idealized situation. And for that, a toy model on a quantum circuit simulator on a powerful laptop is a good starting point. And from there, you build up the complexity. You go to a slightly bigger simulator. You add the noise once you add a noise model, then you typically need to revert to some GPU cluster because then the complexity really starts to explode. And then once that works, then you start implementing on an actual quantum processor. Because if you would do that on day one, and you have all the complexity, everything that can go wrong will go wrong. And you don't know what went wrong because the only thing is that, hey, the algorithm didn't converge. So you need to help yourself in that fundamental research to figure out, okay, I know that this works. So now I'll take it to the next level. Ooh, it doesn't work anymore. So what happened? But yes, definitely you cannot do the whole value chain all the way up to an application if you don't have a quantum processor. then you get stuck somewhere. You have a nice theoretical concept, but you don't know if it works in reality. Yeah, there is a certain order of things. That's the critical sort of insight there.
So I'm glad that you explained that to us, because it's maybe a little bit different to what most engineers and scientists think, that they have access to hardware and they can quickly try out an idea, and the whole idea and the name of the game is doing proof of concepts as quickly as possible. So here it might be slightly different. But I'm curious to hear from you is, when you talk to people about quantum computing and they say, oh, I know what it is, how do you actually describe what makes it interesting? When you're speaking to someone who's maybe not as deep in quantum computing as yourself or your peers, how do you articulate why it puts a smile on your face? So I'm assuming you studied this and you've carried a lot of hours and research has gone into it, so it's part of who you are. But how do you trigger that interest in others who haven't gone through the same path as yourself?
That's a good question. The interesting partial answer to that is that popular scientific press coverage and the hype around quantum is doing a lot of that work for us. So it's rather the opposite, actually. A lot of people come to me, to us, to my colleagues and say, oh, yeah, I heard about this quantum stuff. I need to get my hands on this quantum stuff. We need to work on that. And then you need to put the brakes on it and get some realism into their thinking and turn it around. Okay, so why do you need it? And you're asking them. because I cannot do certain stuff. Oh, okay, okay. So let's figure out what is it that you want to be doing and what is the mathematical thing underneath that? And why are you running into the limits? What are these limits? And then we can figure out, okay, so the problem is shaped in a certain structure. Is it suitable to be solved on a quantum processor or any of these other compute technologies that you just mentioned? Maybe it's better to go for resistive computing or simulated annealing or whatever. But hopefully the person has understood that his or her type of problem is suitable for quantum processors, so that there's some pre-screening happening there. But yeah, so assuming that it is a problem that's suitable, then we can, in many cases, show, for instance, sort of good scientific proof from existing publications or our own research, showing that, look, a similar problem has shown promise here and there and here and there, or there is some complexity theory proof that at some stage it will definitely outperform. So you have to make it credible that it's going to work, or at least has a good chance that it will work. And then the next step will be to engage those people to actually do the joint research, because that's the stage that, where the market is at. We don't have turnkey solutions ready to bring tangible benefits tomorrow. We need the input from these domain experts from industry that actually have a computational need and want to share that computational need with us, so we can find a quantum-based solution for that, and then develop that together and then productize it and make sure that they can use it in practice.
So it feels like the algorithmic part of today's world, when people think of creating software algorithms, that you go broad and you can reach out to millions of people very quickly to get information. But it feels that in your field, where you're looking to have those collaborations, it's actually not such a large audience as people might expect.
I think you have to make the distinction between engaging the audience with quantum, and you can do that for a larger audience by building interesting showcases, having them get access to that in an easy way, playing around with existing pre-programmed or scripted types of things that you can tweak and play with, run on a quantum processor, see how it works, learn from that. So it's less of a presentation, but more sort of playing along with it, learning by doing type of thing. And I think that we're getting to the stage in the market where that becomes important. But on the other hand, there's the fundamental driving force of the research in the sector, which is this smaller audience, the corporates, the domain experts in the corporates, who themselves probably have a PhD in a certain field, that want to contribute to this field further developing and advancing. And we, as software developers, need the interaction with those domain experts, because we have knowledge on quantum, they have knowledge on their field, and you have to bring that together. And then now with Pascal, we then involve a third party, the hardware developer. So it's the domain expert, the software algorithm developer, and the hardware developer all have to come together. And if you have that sort of three-party sort of collaboration, only then can you reach industry-relevant quantum advantage, because that's a term that we started using. As soon as possible, because that's what we need. If we cannot reach industry relevant, so something with business value, quantum advantage in the next couple of years, then at some stage people will start to lose interest. So you have to show that you can actually do something that is valuable with these devices, rather than solving purely theoretical problems. So
how do you make the software accessible and understandable to the corporate users that you talked about there? So they come with a problem and now you're starting to work on it. You guys have built software toolkits to help them understand this. What's some of the kind of onboarding, or some of the things that contribute to the ease of use and being able to get them to ramp up on that quickly?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we were one of the first that started thinking about started asking our clients, basically, how do you want to use this? How is this going to be practical? This was a couple of years ago. Back then, people were trying to figure out how quantum software could actually work and how it could be valuable. And the interesting part was that almost all of our clients, first thing they said, yeah, we believe quantum one day will bring us magical accuracy and improve scaling and whatever. So in that sense, the popular scientific press had done its work. We didn't have to defend that we were working on this. But in the same sentence, they then said, but it's never going to be a standalone solution. we were a bit disappointed, like, because for us, quantum was the world. This was going to revolutionize everything. But they explained quite quickly, in line with what Garrett said some time ago, is that I, as a computational chemist or somebody in doing corporate research, I already have these quite elaborate computational workflows set up in existing conventional software packages. And I'm quite happy with that. In many cases, it works very well. I can do these chemistry simulations. I can do these CFD simulations. But in some cases, I run into limits. And those limits, they're high value problems for me. So I'd like to change that. But that probably means, maybe changing one or two or three steps in my workflow to reach that higher accuracy or to improve the scaling. And as an end user, they told us, we want to be able to do that plug and play. We don't want 2 years of training in quantum computing just to solve that one step, because then I need to learn quantum computing, resistive computing, simulating all of these. I just want the plug and play solution. If it doesn't work with that method, then I'll go for that method. Or ideally, someday I'll get a recommendation.
They want a quantum, or they want a chemistry simulator tool that it's just got a little switch at the top that says, do you want to use the quantum mode? Do you want to use the regular mode? And for this problem, we recommend quantum.
And then a little price tag on it. If you want the accuracy, here it's X. And so when we learned that, we decided, okay, then there's two ways forward. Either we can build a fully classical software package, spend $100 million on that just to sell our quantum software, or we can go the opposite direction and make use of these, of the existence of these leading simulation or other conventional software businesses and integrate with them and go to them and say, hey, you don't yet have quantum capabilities, but you have all these other sort of things. And we have this quantum, or are developing this quantum capability, and we want to bring it to market. We want to build a quantum computational backend to your existing classical software. And the first example of that, we did launch it about three quarters of a year ago now. It's for the chemistry space. It's called QBAC. For quantum backend chemistry, very original name. Many Canadians say, you misspelled QBAC, but it is an acronym. And in that platform, because it's a platform, there are a lot of algorithms that allow you to do chemistry, material science type simulations. You can run them on different types of quantum hardware, or at this stage also on quantum simulators. And then you can access that through an API. So you can just send the data set and receive an answer back. But we also went a little bit further. We partnered with a company called Schrödinger Inc., which is a US-based leading computational chemistry software business. Well, they do a lot more than that, but their packages are computational chemistry software packages. And we integrated this QBAC as a backend to their software. So what you can do is, you, as an end user, you're already used to their molecular design suite. So you can go in there and, for instance, in a 3D designer, just drag and drop and create a molecule. And then you can run that on a classical simulator with classical quantum chemistry, or you can select QBAC as a backend. And just like what they wanted, like a plug and play, a lot of process automation, trying to stay away from the complexity of using all of these quantum processors and just offering it as an end user application. So we think that this is one of the good approaches to making it accessible for a broader audience. It's still not my grandmother or something who can then use it. It's still a knowledgeable user, but at least it's in an existing environment, part of a larger workflow, embedded in what people are used to. It will speed up the adoption of it. It will make it accessible for the audience that needs to start using it as soon as possible.
Yeah. What about the accessibility, for instance, the tooling, and for the people building QBAC, for instance, that you've got this sort of in-between layer? And I think that's also part of what you're trying to do in your market, is supporting those people who are trying to implement. The end goal is this API that just plugs into the existing simulator and provides comparable type of analysis, but faster, better, tick boxes of where it's got some exponential advantage to go do it quantum compared to via traditional computing. But then what about in developing that and sort of educating and understanding the API developer and how to use quantum, how to build that up?
At the moment, we do most of that internally, because we think it's very important to understand all of that and be able to make our own choices and before there are standards. At some stage, you might think that you can outsource certain parts of that. But for now, I think it's best that we do it internally. And then thinking about the complexity of that and what you need to develop is the first thing you need to solve is this problem that none of that quantum hardware is standardized. Mm-hmm. And none of the quantum assembly languages or whatever they are called the same. There's multiple standards or languages there. What we did quite early on is say, okay, we need to be able to develop our algorithms once and then have a wrapper around that, which makes it sort of quasi quantum assembly language agnostic. So it basically allows you to code your circuit once or write your algorithm once and then implement it in different quasims on different types of gate-based still quantum hardware. So there has to be some similarities between the quantum processor, but it doesn't really matter if it's like a Rigetti or an INQ or an IBM or a Pascal or things like that. So that problem we solved quite quickly. We noticed, by the way, that some others are actually productizing that. So the fact that it's hardware agnostic, then they put it out there in the market, like we have a hardware agnostic compiler or something like that. But yeah, we decided to do that internally because what I said, you want to have full control over that whole suite of tools that you need because you don't know which one is going to be the really critical one.
Right.
And you can always outsource, but insourcing, again, is going to be quite complex. So you need to actually build your libraries of algorithms. But that's the work of the quantum algorithm developers. There's a lot of scientific papers out there. So these people are really good at taking sort of a concept that's out there or taking something that our academic groups come up with and then just implementing it and then testing it and improving it, making it more efficient and making it more applied. Because in many cases, an algorithm concept like that is just like that. It's a generic concept. In principle, it can solve a certain mathematical problem, but that doesn't make it into a solution or something like you need to tweak it. You need to tailor it. And in some cases, completely rebuild it. So we're doing that again, all from the ground up, because if you don't build it yourself, but using some standard libraries that are out there, then you're not, how do you call that? Above the matter.
The technology is still sufficiently immature that you really need to get your hands dirty with the hardware.
You need to get your hands dirty because, then the next step would be, okay, how can I improve it? Or actually, okay, now it does this, but it doesn't do that. So how do I go from here to there? If you have a library, then you typically don't really understand what it does.
So maybe just as a quick question, but then you're looking at a very particular type of person or group of people, right? So this is not a computer scientist only. It's not a physicist only. It's not an engineer only or a mathematician. It feels like you need a very rounded and deep, knowledgeable person on many fronts to make this a reality. How do you find these people?
Magnifying glass and try to... No, you can solve part of that problem by having a very diverse team. So yes, ideally you find this one person that combines all of those skills. And I'm happy to say that in my opinion, Vincent, our CTO, is a great person like that. He has the broadness. He can go deep. He can go broad. He has seen a lot. He is very hands-on and theoretically strong. Great to have those people. So you need in your team one or two or three at least of those people who can go all the way. You start complementing that because no matter how well-rounded these people are, you also need the specialists. You need the people, like in our team, we have specialists who are very good in, I don't know, solving problems on the error side, the noise. The others sort of work on everybody has their own specialty. We even have people that, because we are now working on field, both on the classical physics-informed neural networks and the quantum neural network version of that, we have these classical neural network specialists internally. So we have postdoc level people who studied that field and applied it in sort of the industry, because you can learn a lot from the way they solve these type of problems classically and then migrate those learnings to a quantum neural network setting and vice versa as well. Again, you need that diversity. You need specialists who respect each other and know what the other can do. And everybody brings something to the table. So it's, again, I doubt whether there will be a lot of breakthroughs by individuals in garages in this field, because you need to bring so much broadness. And ultimately, what I said, it's you need that software team, which is already quite diverse. Then you need the domain experts from your clients who know everything about fluid dynamics or chemistry or something. And then you need the hardware specialists who know everything about that particular type of hardware that you want to optimize it on.
It sounds like the early days of computer industry where you needed people who could program in assembly, but also understood how the circuits worked, what they connected to, the traditional analog electronics, what the logic is doing, and were able to integrate all of that, as opposed to now where it's all so heavily abstracted away that you really can be a pure software developer.
In a couple of years when what my sort of expectation and hope is that in the next, let's say, 3 years or something, we'll see the first great successes of industry relevant quantum advantage. It may still be sort of narrow quantum advantage or something we do with quantum where it's better than what people are already doing classically, but maybe not the best theoretical classical solution. But still, it outperforms what people are now using. So they're happy about some improvement, and that sort of further drives the industry. But I hope that once we've seen those first successes, that at some stage we'll get to a higher level program. It's called low code type of programming. Mm-hmm. That when it becomes easier for quantum coders to use these pre-programmed modules, elements, and combine stuff to come up with novel ideas and solutions. But before we are there, we need to have those first successes, because based on those first successes, we'll see a convergence on certain standards in quantum computing. If you see, this mathematical problem can be solved in such a way on that type of qubit architecture in a very efficient way, then that automatically starts to become a standard and other people will try to follow on that.
And there's enough of a market and enough revenue in iterating and running that problem.
Once you have those standards, then you can go to lower code. But until you have the standards, it's no use going to the lower code, because what are you lowering then?
Right. You don't know what you're making.
Getting away from the complexity that you actually need to understand to bring it further. It's too soon.
So this is a super interesting field, and I'm sure we can talk for many hours about this. But one thing that I am curious is, how did you even get started in this? So were you like, as a teenager, you always had this idea, quantum computing, this is the way forward, and you saw this when you were like 10 or 12, or what's your super
Einstein
origin story?
My birthday party and then... No, I studied physics in university. One of my best fields was quantum physics. It would have been quite natural to have a whole career in that field. But back then, I wanted to broaden myself. And so I chose to leave industry and join a US consulting firm called the Boston Consulting Group. And after that, I went into the finance sector. So I had a whole career, like 20 years outside of science. And it was probably about 4 years ago, I was running my own consulting firm, and it was doing quite well. Good revenues, it paid the bills and the mortgage, as you might say. But I realized that the consulting project started to look the same, and I was actually getting quite bored with it. And if I get bored, then I'm not the nicest person to work with. So I decided, better for my business if I get a hobby on the side. And that hobby became quantum. So it was around that time, actually, when my advisor from university got some funding from Microsoft to set up a lab and develop quantum computers. And I thought, hey, that's great. This technology that I worked on in university, back then in our papers, we would write, one day people can build qubits from this, but nobody even cared. It was so far away still. But I realized, now people are actually building these devices. And I had a wild idea, could I do a hardware startup? But then I quickly realized, you probably need a couple of hundred million to do that. But maybe software algorithm development is achievable as a startup concept. But again, I started as a hobby. So I locked myself up in the study room every Friday and would read these thick books on quantum information. And I was really enjoying myself as a reward at the end of the week. And I would go into the weekend really energized. And on Monday, at least I would be nice to my clients. So I would keep them. I could continue to pay those mortgages. But so after about 3/4 of a year or something of doing that, there was actually a friend of mine who I had a dinner party. And that friend, I'd been rambling on about quantum for half an hour already. And so he looked at me and said, now I know enough about your hobby. And it was this undertone there. Yeah, you're right, actually. It is a hobby, but that maybe I should switch it around. I should make that hobby into a business. So I tried to make a business out of it. Took me a while to figure out how to do that. Just experimenting, had some naive ideas, tried maybe some consulting in the beginning, but it's not really a market for quantum. And I found a group of freelance potential quantum algorithm developers. I had the idea like, okay, let's do this with this freelance group of developers. Let's work for a couple of years. I'll find the projects. They'll develop the algorithms in their evening hours and the weekends and whatever. And then after a couple of years, we'll figure out how to build a business out of it. Would be great. And everybody's really enthusiastic. And I even got on the shortlist for a project with a very big German company. And I was competing back then with players that sort of are now our peers. But back then, I was really impressed. And one qubit and QC were back then, those were like the big startups. And of course, we lost it terribly. It was a horrible disaster because, you want to do this with sort of freelancers and some academics and you read about this stuff and the website looked cool, but so then I realized, okay, this is only going to work if we actually make a business out of it and really employ these people full time. And that's when QnCo was born. So I, in that final process, I met up with Vincent, who at the time was working in the team of John Martinez at Google in Santa Barbara. So this is the team where Google develops their quantum hardware, and they're really good at that. And within that team, Vincent was working on implementing some quantum computational chemistry and quantum machine learning algorithms. And I thought it was a great experience. So we talked about this startup and he came back to Europe and we started QnCo and the rest is history, I would say.
And with that, this is a great place to stop our conversation today. I wanted to thank you for listening to Tangible Computing. While we have your attention, we really want this podcast to trigger your curiosity and motivate you to engineer a better world. So let us know if you have any ideas for future topics or speakers, or even how to make this podcast better. Just send us an email to tangible@tangiblecomputing.com.